We're going to speak about some evidences of the great worldwide flood. And in presenting this study, we wish to state that we hold no evolutionist ideas whatsoever. These we believe to be blasphemous to the name of the supreme creator of all things, the Lord Jesus Christ. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. The first verse of the Bible declares, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." And further on we read, "God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good." The purpose of this study is to encourage believers in their faith by presenting some evidences of that greatest cataclysm this earth has ever known, and to present some conclusions derived from this, partly through practical observations. First, the fact of the flood. God said to Noah, I do bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh wherein is the breath of life from under heaven. Everything that is in the earth shall die. The flood is a well-established fact in the scriptures, referred to by the Lord himself, and he said, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be also in the days of the Son of Man. Now let us remember, it was universal, worldwide. God said, I will destroy all flesh, not just some of the worst. A local flood would require a greater miracle than a universal one. How would you heap up the waters and keep them heaped up for 150 days higher than the highest mountains, just say in one or two countries? All that God saw at the creation to be very good had now been corrupted. Corruption was universal, and so was the flood. Now the question of the date. Do we have any means whereby we can know the date when the flood took place? While biblical history is too incomplete to allow us to arrive at any date more accurate than approximately 4,000 to 5,000 years ago for the flood, the Bible does give us the day, the month, and the year. Listen to Genesis 7:11. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up and the floodgates of heaven were opened. While we don't know very accurately how long ago took place this day, month, and year, it is interesting to note that the 17th day of the second month has been found to correspond to the first day of November, according to our present-day calendar. And that day is almost universally known as the Day of All Saints, or, as in some places, the Day of the Dead. What dead? Does this All Saints, or Day of the Dead, have its origin in that day when the waters began to cover the earth, when all humanity but 8 persons died? In this cemetery, they have placed flowers on the 1st of November, the Day of the Dead, as they do in many parts of the world. Before dealing with some of the physical evidences of the flood, we want to mention the extreme violence of that unique world cataclysm that so changed this whole earth that the Apostle Peter could write of two distinct worlds, the world that then was, before the flood, and the heavens and the earth which are now, since the flood. The scriptures that mention the flood often give the impression of violence on a colossal scale. In Matthew 24, verse 39, the Lord said that everyday life was going on normally until the flood came and took them all away, not the gentle filling of a low basin where a few people happened to live. They didn't drown in their sleep. In Luke 17:27, the Lord describes the same thing in other words, where he says, the flood came and destroyed them all. The Apostle Peter in his second letter says, the world that then was being overflowed with water, perished. The world was not simply filled up with water, it was overflowed or flowed over with water and perished. Great violence is suggested in these scriptures. Before going on any further, we must make it quite clear that if you wish to follow this presentation of some evidences of the flood, you must accept the fact of the incalculable violence of that greatest of all cataclysms. What forces were unleashed by the Almighty God when all the fountains of the great deep were broken up and the floodgates of heaven were opened? In line with these scriptures is the hypothesis suggested by the late Dr. Shelley, an evangelical Christian who made an intense study of the flood. His thought was that God in his omnipotence could have used the close passing of a comet such as Halley's Comet, which with its tremendous gravitational pull could have broken up the seabeds and caused tremendous waves miles high to rush around the Earth at 1,000 miles per hour, which is the speed of the Earth's rotation. The result of this mighty movement of rushing waters staggers the imagination, but could supply the answer to some otherwise inexplicable evidences of violence around the world. A cataclysm of this kind did completely change the Earth at the time of the flood, and answers the evolutionist problems of disconformity to their geologic column, which they are still keenly seeking and hoping to find correctly lined up with their requirements. The flood left no orderly uniform geologic layers or strata. Rather, it left confusion everywhere, frequently with marine organisms in the mountaintops and creatures of the mountaintops way down at the bottom of their so-called geologic column. The story the fossils tell needs no alteration to line up with what God tells us in the scriptures. We believe that before the flood, the earth was very much lower in relation to the sea level. When all the fountains of the great deep were broken up and enormous volumes of water came forth, a great deal of the earth would have to sink to take the place of the water. When the windows of heaven or the floodgates of heaven were opened and it rained for 40 days and nights incessantly, we believe it did not refer to clouds, but to water in a different form. It's calculated that should all the water that is suspended in the clouds around the earth fall at one time, it might cover the earth's surface with about perhaps a few inches of water. It was different before the flood. It seems that rain was unknown then, as in the Edenic state. Genesis 2 tells us, "The Lord God had not caused it to rain upon the earth, but there went up a mist from the earth and watered the whole face of the ground." It would appear that there was a great water canopy far above the earth, because in the creation account of the first page of the Bible, we learn that God made the firmament, or as we call it, the heavens or skies, and divided the waters which were under the heavens from the waters, not clouds, which were above the heavens. This would not, of course, exclude the light of the sun nor the moon. It could have been near invisible, or like a very thin cloud layer. At the left of the diagram is an illustration of what we have proposed, a low earth with no high mountains protected by the water canopy far above. What form these waters took we are not told, but we know they were there because the scriptures tell us so, that they were part of that which the Creator saw to be very good. Knowing this, we can understand some of its effects. For example, green sappy leaves, like those of rhubarb or corn, even when they lack no moisture, under the burning heat of a clear sunshine, wither badly and even burn in patches. These same plants, in moderately cloudy weather, thrive with no such setbacks as they would during the existence of the water canopy. Of God's perfect irrigation system before it was spoiled by the fall, we read, "There went up a mist or vapor from the earth and watered the whole face of the ground." Would this work under a clear sky and sunshine? In whatever form it took, the water canopy provided exactly the conditions necessary to produce this mist. We might add that some scientists today admit the scientific possibility of suspension of waters in some form far above the earth. When this great canopy of water fell incessantly for more than a month worldwide, as no rain as we know it ever could, the earth was completely covered even to about 6 meters above the highest hills. This can be noted at the center of the diagram. The original earth, low and covered completely by the flood waters without the water canopy above, which has now fallen. Note at the right in the diagram how the earth was left after the destruction of the flood, with the earth pushed up to great heights and no protective water canopy above. Before leaving the subject of the water canopy, let us consider several other things that it might also explain. How is it that at one time the world climate was so uniform that now under polar ice fossils are found of tropical plants and animals? This canopy acted as the glass of a glasshouse and kept the climate near uniform without strong winds, nor storms, nor deserts. How can one explain the greater size in plants, animals, and man before the flood? And how explain the greater age to which man lived? Pre-deluge men lived up to over 900 years. Our allotted span today is 70 years. It is known today that the direct radiation from the sun is a life-shortening factor. Before a water canopy fell at the flood time, it filtered these ultraviolet and other rays, and all life lived longer and grew larger. Why do we read of God setting the rainbow in the clouds for the first time only after the flood? Genesis 9. It was because there were then rains and clouds. For the first time, conditions necessary to form a rainbow, which God put there and uses as a sign of his covenant with man, never again to subject the earth to a deluge that would destroy all flesh. It is certain, however, that when the flood ceased and the waters dried from off the face of the earth, the whole earth suffered tremendous convulsions, and the mountains and the whole earth were elevated higher than they ever were before. As a marginal reading of verse 8 of Psalm 104, which describes the flood, says, "The mountains ascend, the valleys descend." And this explains much that to those who deny the flood is inexplicable. Without this action, what explanation is to be found for the enormous amounts of marine fossils existing at nearly 4,000 meters above the present sea level, as in this photo where there are thousands of seashells in volcanic ash at 3,000 meters above sea level? Many times these marine fossils are found above the fossils of land animals. What explanation can be given for the generally accepted geologic column that is rarely, if ever, found in that official order, but rather is continually confused and changed? Our evolutionist friends, how do you explain that frequent brief intrusion of the sea in this ever-changing set of geologic strata? If you will accept it, the flood will assist you a great deal in this. As we continue this study, we shall be referring to fossil beds and other evidences in Bolivia, and these mostly in the mountains. But first we wish to know what petrifies. For today there is virtually nothing petrifying anywhere in the world. The necessary conditions to petrify just don't exist. Yet there are fossil beds worldwide containing the petrified remains of innumerable animals, birds, and sea creatures. It is admitted that these have been killed and buried by water, all at the same time. Can you think of anything apart from a universal flood that could do this? An earthquake couldn't do it. Famine couldn't do it. Sickness couldn't. Some learned people have said, nobody knows why, after thriving for so long, the dinosaurs suddenly died out. In fact, a recurring problem and riddle commonly mentioned by evolutionists writing on the subject is, why did the dinosaurs suddenly disappear? What caused their sudden total extinction? Can you think of anything about a universal flood that could exterminate them all suddenly and leave their bones worldwide in sedimentary layers? That is where you will find the fossils today, in sedimentary layers. You look in vain to find fossils to any extent apart from those fossilized by the flood. And the pair that came through the flood in the ark, why did they die out, those dinosaurs? Where are their fossils? Their ancestors died out during the flood, and some were fossilized by the flood. These descendants that came forth from that pair that were saved could well have died out because of the destroyed earth and climate since the flood. Maybe man exterminated them, just as he is responsible for the extermination of an alarming number of species of birds and animals, even in this present day. And the fossil bones of these dinosaurs that died since the flood, where are they? They don't exist. Just as you don't find fossils of any animals that lived since the flood through to the present because there was no flood to fossilize them, so you don't find fossils of those dinosaurs that died after the flood. They didn't fossilize any more than the innumerable horses, cows, and sheep that have existed since the flood fossilized. Perhaps we are running ahead of our first question, which is, what petrifies? How are things fossilized? To be petrified, an animal must be buried immediately and under some pressure. What petrifies is the basic question which must be answered. Petrification is so often avoided, or just taken for granted, as a slow process taking place over thousands of years. This in itself is an impossibility, as evidenced by fossils of some soft-bodied creatures, particularly marine, where even the intricate form of the eyes is preserved. In some cases, the body itself is decayed, but the impression of the skin of the body is left imprinted in hard stone just as clearly as fine fingerprints. Could these things have been so perfectly preserved? Should petrification require even a year? Here in the photo is a little trilobite found at nearly 2,000 meters above sea level near Tarija in Bolivia. It is curled up into a little ball with the end of its tail tight under its chin, which appears to be a defensive pose. Its whole body surface is beautifully preserved, even its eyes showing like minute honeycomb. Now look at this round stone, which when opened revealed a half-inch space that was full of fine coffee-colored powder, the rotted body of some sea creature which left the fine imprint of its soft skin in the surface of the cavity of the stone. The rapid petrification of this stone was caused by some reaction to the body in the sediment. This was possibly accomplished within days or hours, as man does today by adding water to cement. Thousands of these round or oval stones with traces of bodies within can be found at altitudes of up to 3,000 meters in Bolivia. They are unmistakably marine fossils, as evidenced by the presence in some of tiny seashells. These stones were originally in layers of soft shale in the hills. In the photo is a large one of these, almost a meter in diameter, encrusted in the shale rock where it was formed originally. During the cataclysm of the flood, when everything went before it, hills and mountains were formed of primeval earth and buried untold numbers of these sea creatures alive. The reaction to their bodies resulted in the rapid petrification of the sediment immediately around the body. The rest of the sediments petrified much slower, forming the layers of shale over and around these stones with the bodies in them. Petrification like this is not taking place in the sea today. Creatures that die in the sea today are either eaten by others or rapidly decay. These were buried under tremendous pressure and in types of primeval earth that had probably never before been exposed to water. What was the origin of petroleum? Now take the case of petroleum or oil, which is sometimes referred to as fossil fuel. It is known that petroleum comes mainly from fish. In sedimentation tanks, shark's teeth and fish scales have been found. Is there anywhere in the world today where petroleum is forming under the sea or in the ground? All the petroleum was formed a long time ago as a direct result of the flood, when those teeming billions of fish that filled the seas at that time were buried under tremendous pressure. You might ask, how do fish become buried? In normal sea conditions of today, they don't. But remember, the flood produced the most abnormal, cataclysmic conditions this world has ever known. Imagine those fish trying to escape those thundering waters that moved hills and formed new ones, perhaps suffocated by those silt-laden waters. Add to that the heat that burst forth from the bowels of the earth when the fountains of the great deep were broken up. In Bolivia, where there is a period of about 7 months without rain, when the first rain of the season comes and floods the rivers, their water is almost as thick as paint. When people hear the roar of the river, they will even get up at 2 o'clock in the morning to go down to the river's edge and with their hands pull out little fish that are gasping for water. If such conditions are found in a little river when it floods, what would it have been like during the flood of Noah's day? And did it take millions of years to turn all those dead fish into petroleum? It is believed that under sufficient pressure, coal and oil could be made from waste matter within a period of half an hour. In Genesis 6 is the first mention of the Bible, or in the Bible, of pitch, a petroleum product. Here it is mentioned in relation to the ark. God told Noah to pitch the ark within and without. For years, this presented a problem. For while one was convinced that the origin of petroleum was at the flood, one could not explain its presence before the flood, when it was used in the ark. It surely must have been some other substance used in the ark, but its name translated into English by the same word as that used correctly in other places for pitch. The Hebrew scriptures hold the answer. The reference in Genesis 6:14 is to the resin of gopher, the very wood of which the ark was made. So what was used in the ark has no reference to pitch or tar. But the very next reference to slime or pitch in Genesis 11, verse 3, does mean bitumen. At the Tower of Babel, after the flood, they had plenty to use instead of mortar. And so there was no petroleum before the flood. Then there is the matter of the origin of coal, which is petrified plant matter, mostly wood. The photo shows a thick layer of coal, in this case near the surface of the ground. It is calculated that it took 9 meters of vegetation debris to form a 1 meter seam of coal. Have you or anyone else in the world today seen coal in the process of being formed in some great forest? When a tree dies and falls, it begins to rot, and there's usually very little left of it by the time another tree dies and falls across it. The necessary conditions just do not exist today to form coal. Then what piled together and buried thousands, billions of tons of trees at such depths that gave the necessary pressure to turn it all into coal? Can you think of anything but a universal flood that could do this and give us coal around the world today? Let us consider the salt lakes or salt beds that exist in different parts of the world, some at great altitudes above sea level. These are the remains of ancient seas where the ocean waters have evaporated and left the salt in solid form where once it was suspended in the water. There is the example of the salt lake of Union, Bolivia, at 3,660 meters above the sea level, which is shown in this photo. This lake is 80 kilometers wide and 140 kilometers long, perfectly dry except in the wet season. Of salt, there's a distinct thickness of about 15 centimeters on top of black mud. Seashells and remains of coral can be found on the shore. Along the sides of the distant hills, there is a distinct sea level line left on the rocks. How does one explain this great basin of seawater at such a height above sea level? It was pushed up during the terrible flood movements. Earth's great mountain ranges could not have existed prior to the flood. If they were then at their present height, where did all the water go to that covered their peaks without anywhere to drain? They were pushed up from below, taking sea remains up with them. That is why often marine fossils and those of land animals are found together at great heights. I was once with an evolutionist and his companion digging out the huge head and other remains of a mastodon at about 2,000 meters above sea level, shown in the photo here. While we were eating our lunch a few meters further up, where there was shade, I picked up a pebble with sea fossils in it. My friend confessed to being unable to explain why the marine fossil was in a higher layer than the mastodon. The flood didn't keep all the debris it buried in any neat order. In fact, strata left by water movements of this nature would necessarily be most erratic and inconsistent, just what you find anywhere, even where the evolutionists are still looking for their prescribed order. What was the origin of the rounded water-washed stones on the face of the earth, sometimes in alluvial layers at great heights in the hills, as seen in this photo? When as a lad I climbed the hills on the farm in Nelson, New Zealand, there was one thing that puzzled me. Many of the hills were composed of rounded water-washed stones. Somebody said they had long ago been under the sea and had been washed round in the water movements in the seabed. But is it not on the surface of the waters where the movement is, and in the depths mostly calm? Others said they were weathered. But apart from a few types of water-soluble rocks, when does weather ever take the corners off hard stones and make them round? These round milled stones, from the size of gravel to the size of a house, are found all over the world, and at great heights above sea level. In Bolivia, water-deposited layers of these stones are found at 3,500 meters above sea level, way up in the tops of the mountains. Could these possibly have been weathered into that form? In New Zealand, as no doubt in other countries, some people's hobby is tumble polishing stones. Rough, common-looking stones and rocks, when tumble polished, become rounded and beautiful gemstones. Selected stones are put into a perpetually revolving drum with abrasive grit for from 3 to 12 weeks. No stone subjected to this treatment can stay rough and jagged. During the flood, the earth's surface was subjected to just such treatment on a very, very large scale. Can you think of anything else that could have milled these stones all over the earth's surface? What was the origin of the worldwide sedimentary layers? This photo shows a rock face with more than 40 sedimentary layers. It is a well-known fact that enormous sedimentary layers are found all over the world and at almost any level from sea to mountaintops. It is also a well-known fact that most of the animal fossils are found in these sedimentary layers, or water-deposited strata of earth, sand, gravel, or rock. If these sedimentary layers were found uniformly near sea level, it might be a little easier to understand the evolutionist theory that the lower forms of life were in the lower layers when they were surface layers, and little by little they were covered by higher layers with higher life in them. But this is never the case. Never was. The fossil-bearing sedimentary layers are sometimes above 4,000 meters, and the erosion, whether by rivers or weather, always cuts through these layers, even forming canyons, never forming great sedimentary plains of this nature. What then formed these great worldwide sedimentary strata, often fossil-bearing? To answer this, apart from the flood, is very difficult. These layers are seldom, if ever, found anywhere in the order of the evolutionist geologic column, which is so necessary to their theory. The flood never yielded to man's theories. These must yield to the flood. A parallel question on which we have already touched is, how does anything become fossilized? This question must be honestly faced and answered. Firstly, nothing ever petrifies just lying on the surface of the ground. Yet so many people either ignore the basic cause of petrification, or they simply expect you, without thinking, observing, or judging for yourself, to believe that things just petrified anywhere on the surface. An illustration of this is found in a well-known American evolutionist journal, where there is a diagram to illustrate their theory of early life from the seabed to the beach. Any explanation of the animals at the different levels, they explain that some were stranded on the sand of the beach, where they were fossilized. Has anyone seen creatures on the sands of any beach in the world today being fossilized? The Great Flood accounts for almost all of the world's fossils because it buried them suddenly, some alive, many immediately after death, in the tremendous layers of heavy sediments. Let us examine some of these sedimentary layers way up in the hills in Bolivia. We begin out on the relatively flat area nearly 2,000 meters above sea level around the city of Tarija, which is surrounded in the distance by mountains, some of which reach nearly 4,000 meters. In this fairly well-known fossil basin, fossil fragments of nearly 40 kinds of animals have been found, the most common being mastodon, glyptodon, horse, giant ground sloth, and llama. The photo shows the lower jaw of a mastodon, also some mastodon's molars. The following photo will show the paw or hand of a giant ground sloth of the Celidodon type. In extensive areas, tremendous erosion has left a terrain about as harsh as you might find anywhere, consisting of endless gullies and crevices as well as steep peaks that give a good cross-section of the sedimentary layers. In the upper layers, the fossils have been deposited in layers like these in the photo. As usual, the best preserved parts of the skeleton are the molars and tusks. Anything like a complete skeleton deposited in one place is rarely found. That which is more evident is the fact that in these layers are usually found isolated bones or fragments of bones that have been brought there and deposited separately after being fossilized. The case illustrated in the photo shows at the left the lower jaw of a mastodon. In the alluvial layer at the right, a mastodon's tusk is beginning to show as the erosion uncovers it. Both pieces were water deposited in this alluvial layer. Perhaps a molar here, a piece of leg or rib over there, broken straight across as would happen only after petrification, not splintered or a green break. I have found just one bone, a small mastodon tusk, that had been broken green or before petrification. Why, if these bones had been deposited there by the flood, were they brought and deposited in these sedimentary layers after being fossilized? For years, this was a problem, till solved through observation. Out on the perimeter of this fossil area, in some places up on the hillsides, are remains of many sedimentary layers, many meters higher than those down below, as can be seen in the photo here. If you examine these layers, you will still find isolated fragments of bone embedded there. But go on up to that highest place where there is still a vestige of sedimentary layers, and you will find what is obviously the remains of the original layer of fossils. The protruding edge of this strata of fossils can be traced around the same layer in this higher peak. Those layers down below are secondary layers that formed when those mountains were pushed up from the flood level, when millions of tons of water drained off them to settle in the secondary sedimentary layers in the valley below, in the process breaking up those fossils and grinding most to powder. Some of this action could have taken place later, even years later, when great bodies of water were released as natural dams gave way. There are seven widely separated areas where remnants of this original layer of fossils can be seen. These are always at the highest level of these strata, which, since they were deposited there 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, have suffered the effects of heavy erosion. These enormous sedimentary layers were not formed gradually from the valley up. In some mysterious, unscientific way, fossilizing animals as they died on the surface. The present top layers were formed first, with their fossils buried deep within. Then, with the earth and its mountains, these layers were pushed up out of the floodwaters to their present elevation. In the process, most of those upper layers were washed down, lower, forming new layers with fractured, shattered fossils embedded in them. During this lifting up process, which was worldwide, most of that original fossil layer was lost. That is why fossils are found today only in certain areas where the milling action of the draining waters was not too severe or extensive. The fossil story is not evidence of a gradual evolution of life, but rather undeniable evidence of the sudden destruction of life when, by the flood, God destroyed the whole earth with fallen man in all his rebellion and sin. One of the clearest evidences of this cataclysm are those worldwide communal graveyards where the shattered skeletons of innumerable animals of all kinds are mixed together, a silent testimony to the flood, a silent testimony to the true nature of fallen man, for whose sins this state of death was brought upon the whole world. What was the origin of marine fossils? Another evidence of the Great Flood is provided by the numerous marine fossils virtually all over the country, from low levels to the mountain tops, in many cases far above the land animals. Does that mean that the floodwaters covered these mountain peaks, some at 4,000 meters, in their present elevation? In relation to the present earth, where was sea level during the flood? Unless you are at this present moment close to the sea level, the maximum flood level was probably below where you are now standing. After the flood, most of the present land above sea level was pushed up out of the waters to its present elevation. Remember, during creation, God separated the dry land from the waters. The dry land was brought up from under the waters, for the whole earth was covered with waters, as in the flood. Now remember, God did the same thing after the flood had accomplished his purposes. He separated the land again from the waters that had covered it by pushing it up vertically in enormous continental upthrusts. Today the summit of Mount Ararat is over 5,000 meters above sea level. God tells us in Genesis 8 that the ark rested upon the mountains of Ararat, and it may be that one day God will allow some of its remains to be found up there. Maybe some have already been found. But can you imagine the ark during the flood floating above those mountains in their present elevation? God remembered Noah and every living thing that was with him in the ark and kept them safe through those frighteningly turbulent waters. Perhaps then he finally cradled his ark on an emerging summit and elevated it to perhaps 5,000 meters to view a scene of utter desolation. The earth destroyed, as he said he would destroy it, a scene of death. What a warning to Noah and his family, to their descendants, to us, as to what is the end of the way of sin. Why do the great mountain ranges appear to be new? All the world's great mountain ranges are said to be geologically new. They were like Mount Ararat, elevated after the flood, when, as we read in Psalm 104, the mountains ascend and the valleys descend. When the topography and the pleasant climate of that world before the flood was changed, resulting in rugged terrains, vast oceans, and violent climates of the present world. That is why the great mountain ranges appear to be new, because they were pushed up from underneath after the flood without being milled by those flood waters like the rest of the earth's surface. That is why fossils are found virtually at any altitude, not only where the evolutionists would like to find them. That too is why marine fossils are found among fossils of animals like the llama that belongs to the highest altitudes, the mastodon from lower down, and the riverine animals like the capybara of the tropics. These have all been found in fossil beds out from Tarija. I have an evolutionist friend, and we have discussed these things together. Once I gave him a complete mastodon tusk that was just under 1 meter 80 centimeters long that we had dug out of alluvial layers of fine gravel and sand. When he was cleaning it, he found in the hollow end of the tusk, in the long tapered bone cavity, minute marine fossils. This brings us to an important point which must be emphasized. All those ancient fossils were once under the sea. That was when the floodwaters covered the whole earth. Only afterwards, when the earth was thrust up, were these left in their present locations, some at tremendous heights, marine and mammal fossils together. Yes, all the fossils were once under the sea. That is where they were mixed up together, and that is where many of the sedimentary layers were formed, and where the fossils were first buried. When the earth was heaved up out of the flood waters, these great masses of bones were not always kept in orderly complete skeletons, nor were they left in order according to the kinds, like carnivorous and herbivorous. The fossil fields speak of violence and confusion and the complete absence of any geological column. Now the nature of marine fossils. Continuing the theme of marine fossils, I should like to tell you about two stones, each weighing about 100 kilos, both similar in shape and form, and each consisting of the same substance, and both found in the hills in the same area, about 2,500 meters above sea level. They are round and on the underside tapered off to a point, with a thin layer of petrified silt covering the lower side. The upper surface of one is hollow, like a shallow basin. The whole stone has the appearance of the filling of a little eddy or whirlpool in the muddy bottom of turbulent waters. This is especially emphasized when you see that all the substance of the stone consists of thousands of marine creatures, some very small and some up to 5 inches long. They form one solid mass of bodies tightly packed together, not side by side in any order, but crisscrossed in the most disorderly fashion. This conveys the impression of thousands of little creatures in an exceedingly agitated state, struggling for a place of refuge in a hollow, till they were suddenly buried and subsequently petrified and later elevated to the mountaintops, where now the goats feed on the thorn trees amongst the rocks. In this same area, we have found many of the round stones with petrified marine creatures in them, which we have already mentioned, actually of individual creatures like the larger ones in the big stones. Amongst these stones, there are some complete stones with only about half a body in them, as shown in this photo. There are complete stones with half a body in them, not a partially decomposed body, but what appears to have been half a fresh body that caused the silt around it to quickly petrify. Is this another evidence of the violence of the flood? Were these bodies crushed or cut in half by moving stones before they were buried and petrified? What was the origin of fossilized fruits and seeds? In the area where the great Amazon basin of Brazil extends into the extreme north of Bolivia, there's a variety of fossils, including giant tortoises like the one in the photo, turtles, fish, crocodiles, mammals, and some fossils not identified, possibly dinosaur. These were often found extremely fragmented, the pieces forming a sort of mosaic in what is about the only kind of rock found there in some riverbeds, a conglomerate of soft shale-like stone. Real stone and hard rock are virtually unknown there, so much so that a missionary's boy asked his father, who was to make a trip out of this area, to bring him back some pebbles. Do you know what that boy sometimes used in his sling? He was using rather rare fossils. They were fossilized fruits and seeds. You may ask, what did that have to do with the flood? Would they not have fossilized in the bottom of those deep, muddy rivers? I think not. I think they originated in the flood. There may be some down in the mud of those rivers, but they would have fallen there from above. That vast area is so flat that when one river in particular floods, it filters through the forest for kilometers and gives the impression of the forest permanently growing out of the water. But there are some higher banks, and it is in these where occasionally there's what appears to be a thin layer of pebbles. If you shake these pebbles, they rattle. If you open them with a hacksaw or emery cutter, you find the fruit separate from the thin shell, and it looks like a lump of hard plasticine. I ate a piece once. It tasted a little musty, but it was rather novel to be eating fruit that had been preserved for at least 4,000 years. Are these fruits and seeds fossilizing anywhere today? When fruit falls to the ground, if it is not eaten, it rots. In that country, there are also Brazil nuts in the forest. These trees drop hundreds of very hard, round pods, each containing 2 or 3 dozen nuts. If you pass by in a year's time, you won't find any edible nuts, for they are well on the way to complete decomposition. Those fossil seeds are originally located in the higher ground that obviously is in its original place since the days of the flood, which buried the seeds immediately under such conditions that they petrified. Some years ago, in this Amazon basin area in Bolivia, a foreign oil company was drilling in a grid pattern in a wide area. They found a uniform deep layer of sand, water-washed sand. I think this layer began at 20 meters, though I'm not certain on this point, but it was at a constant depth, and the layer was very deep in thickness. Asked what would have formed that layer of sand, one of the drilling heads of the work said it could not be anything else but the flood. It was obvious to him, though he did not profess to be a Christian. Now let us go away up into the Altiplano area beyond La Paz to Lake Titicaca, the highest navigable lake in the world at 3,800 meters above sea level. The people in that area, the Aymaras, have their flood legend. Not far from this lake, there is the famous Tiwanaku area of exceedingly ancient ruins, whose history nobody knows. When the Incas came, the ruins were already very old, and the Incas knew nothing of their history. All is shrouded in mystery. Whatever conclusion we might form regarding the time when this very advanced civilization existed, there are 2 obvious factors to consider. First, the tremendously high quality of workmanship is far superior to anything found in the marvelous Inca ruins. One wonders where, if anywhere in the world today, this high standard of stonework could be challenged. For example, in the ruins of some large structure in the area called Pumapunca, there are several stone blocks more than 2 meters square and perhaps 1/2 meter thick, with each face and angle cut clean, square, and smooth. And the 2 large faces are unvaryingly flat and smooth like glass, and there's not even a scratch, less a chisel mark. The huge foundation floor stones that are perhaps 5 meters long, 3 wide, and 2 deep, have the pattern chiseled in them to take the uneven form of the base of the huge pillars that once stood in them. Contemplating this, and a great deal more, in all honesty, you have to admit that known fact. The further back you go into antiquity, the higher the intelligence revealed by archaeology. Could these ruins be remains of some pre-deluge city? The second factor we want to note is that these ruins have been buried not by wind-blown sand, but rather by solid earth. Even those great foundation stones just mentioned, partially buried in such a way that more readily suggests violent water action than that of an earthquake. Perhaps one day the hieroglyphics engraved in the huge arch called the Gate of the Sun will be deciphered and help solve the mystery of this place. It is our belief that it is reasonably possible that these ruins are of pre-deluge origin. Now what about these footprints left in sediments now petrified, as shown in the photo? There are footprints in stone in Bolivia and the USA and other countries of the world. These are certainly not extensive when you take into account the innumerable tracks from those of dinosaurs to those of man that must have been made in the awful mud and sediments worldwide as the flood waters were rising. But then, the flood was of such a nature that it would wipe out almost immediately the tracks made by all kinds of life trying till the end to flee from those terrifying waters. In the rock bottom of the Paluxy River in the States, there are dinosaur and man tracks side by side and even crossing each other. Tracks of a man, a woman, and a child in one place, near tracks of those great beasts, all fleeing together, evidently without that fear and dread of man in the animals that is only mentioned in the scriptures after the flood. Some of these human tracks are enormous, as to be expected. For Genesis 6, the first chapter in the Bible that tells of the flood and the reason of the flood, says in verse 4, there were giants in the earth in those days. Evidently, there were some sheltered places where the sediments that had washed down by those thundering waters falling from the heavens were more gently covered by other silts, and so tracks made in them were petrified. Let us take a look at some of those petrified footprints in Bolivia. These are situated at the end of a road not far from the geographical center of Bolivia at 2,600 meters above sea level. This fairly wide valley was flat when the flood sediments were forming, when those troops of various kinds of dinosaurs and other animals, including mastodons, left their hundreds of tracks, which were somehow gently covered by other sediments without being destroyed. Thus these footprints, some as far as 6 rock layers down, and some under nearly 5 feet of sedimentary rock, are preserved for us today. The footprints we are describing are not now on the flat, but rather on the steep hillside. This is because they were formed during the flooding of the earth when it was flatter and lower. But when the waters receded afterwards by the elevation of the mountains and the sinking of the valleys, they were left in their present location on the hillsides. On either side of this valley, there is a line of round-topped, shovel-shaped rock faces, some nearly vertical, as these in the photo. Each would be perhaps 200 meters high, and is composed of layer upon layer of sedimentary rock, mostly sandstone. It is on one of these not-so-vertical rock faces where the footprints are found, as these, which could be of mastodon. They don't cover the whole face, because some of the upper layers of rock have fallen away while other parts are still covered with a depth of earth and stone. Some footprints disappear under these patches, but if you follow in the direction, in the same direction, you can see the prints again as they emerge on the other side. All of these tracks observed, except 3 tiny ones, are facing the same general direction, irrespective of what layer they're in. Many are three-toed, about 25 centimeters long by 15 wide. These follow a slightly zigzag line like that of a hen and show a minimum stride of 1 meter, 20 centimeters. In the photo, one such line can be seen as it emerges from the water in the creek, then climbs the sloping rock to disappear under 1 meter, 45 centimeters of rock. The lower edge of this rock has fallen away, thus exposing the footprints that were under it. Other tracks are very much larger and in parallel lines, 1 meter apart, with a stride of 2 meters, 30 centimeters. The tracks average 0.5 meter long by 28 centimeters wide inside and are as much as 20 centimeters deep. Around them, the mud bulged up as those heavy feet sank through what was evidently fairly solid sediment, leaving the tracks surrounded by heaped up mud, now rock. In that valley there are marine fossils, shells, and even pieces of coral. Again we are faced with the fact that all fossils were once under the sea. And again we ask, was that not during the flood? So remember, without the flood or something very similar, you cannot have worldwide fossil fields as they are today. Then remember that the flood left us many evidences of the extreme violence of that cataclysm. Again remember, God tells us that he did bring a flood, just such a flood, upon the whole earth. If you take away the evidences that we have been considering and apply them to something else, you must deny the flood, which by its very nature demands just such evidences. So if we look around us and observe with an unbiased mind, we don't lack evidences of the flood. In the earth, in the fossils, and even in archaeology, and man himself, and in his legends. We need none of these things, of course, to prove the scriptures. The Scriptures never need to be defended or proved. Let a lion loose and he will defend himself. What needs defending is whatever so-called science or geology or what you like to name that doesn't line up with the Bible. Do you think that the one who created the universe doesn't know science, doesn't know astronomy? The one who formed the earth doesn't know geology? Where the Bible touches any branch of science, geology, or anything you like to name, it is the infallible and final authority. Why? Because its author is the only infallible scientist, the Creator himself. And the first of the Proverbs says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom."